The Surface Surfaces.
And if yesterday was all about Greece, today the focus is back on Spain. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, June 19th.
After yesterday's Greece-a-palooza, a little more variety this morning, right, Jeremy? Of course, we're talking about Spain and their debt problems.
That's right, and Microsoft and its new tablet computer and a whole lot more.
Yeah, we had housing start information out today. We'll talk to the Volkswagen CEO, Google. We'll get right to that after this.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Okay, just to start off here, I love this little glimpse from the G20 meeting that's going on in Mexico. Of course, we have all these world leaders who are just about to come out later today with a statement expressing unity and comedy about standing together in the face of global economic turmoil and all that. But everybody's very tense down there, I think. And at one point, the European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, got bumped off just a little bit from all the kumbaya talking points.
This crisis was not originated in Europe. This crisis was originated in North America. But we are not putting the blame on our partners. What we are saying is, let's work together when we have a problem like the one we have today.
And just like that, everybody's friends again. So, of course, everybody now is talking about Spain today. And concern about Spanish banks has pushed the government's borrowing costs over 7%, which is sort of a bellwether number. It's a level that has knocked other smaller European countries like Greece over the edge when their interest rates shot that high. Alfredo Pastor is a former deputy finance minister, and now he's an economist at the IESE Business School in Spain. Professor Pastor, welcome.
Good morning.
Connect the dots for us quickly here, if you would. In a fairly short time, it seems like we've gone from talking about the bailout of a single bank, albeit a large one, Bankia, to talking about Europe needing to intervene to essentially support the entire Spanish economy and government. How did we get so quickly from A to B?
Well, I think that the way that the Bankia crisis was handled scared the markets a little bit. For the time being, they seem to distrust the entire Spanish banking system. Until the report comes from these two companies that have been hired to look at the banking accounts, I think that the markets will remain wary about financing the Spanish banking sector.
I read a report from an analyst this morning that suggested a sovereign bailout for Spain is inevitable at this point. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. The problem we have is not a problem of public debt, it is a problem of private debt. Now, of course, if you assume that the entire banking debt is going to be nationalized, then, of course, you have a problem with the public debt. But there's no reason to assume that.
If it were to come to that, the current president of Spain seems to think a bailout can proceed without having to make the kind of changes that will affect people's way of life. Austerity is the watchword for it. What do you think?
If we did have a bailout, then, of course, the intervention would be much more strict than it is today. The people who would bail us out would want to keep a closer eye to what we do. Certainly conditions would change.
That is the critical difference between the private bailout of a bank and the sovereign bailout of Spain.
Yes.
Professor Alfredo Pastor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, here in this country, there is good news and bad news on the housing front this morning. New home construction fell last month, but building permits, which are an indication of future construction, were actually at their highest level in 4 years. That mixed bag is why the word recovery is still probably too strong a word for the housing market, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
A recent survey of home builders found them slightly more optimistic about the housing market. David Crow is chief economist with the National Association of Home Builders.
We expect to see continued improvement. It won't be fast, it won't be furious, but it will be steady.
Still, Crow says one obstacle home builders face is
stiff competition from foreclosed homes, and some of them at very distressed prices.
On the positive side for consumers, house prices have fallen and mortgage rates are low. But housing market consultant Tom Lawler says prospective borrowers still have a hard time getting a mortgage.
Conditions are a lot tighter than several years ago. They're not as much tighter as, say, the early 90s, but they are still tighter.
Even with tighter loan requirements, there are pockets of growth, especially in the middle of the country. But economist Crow says traditionally strong housing markets, like Atlanta, Phoenix, and Southern California, have yet to bounce back. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
In this real estate market, you can buy a lot of house right now for $270,000 in many parts of the country. But let's get a little glimpse of somewhere else. In one small corner of England, at least, $270,000 will only go so far. Here's a snapshot of this overseas housing market from Stephen Beard.
British beaches are not what you'd call stunning. More hard pebbles than silky white sand. Often they're whipped by a stiff wind from the channel, and so far this summer lashed with rain. That's why in some places you need a hut so you don't get pneumonia. But $270,000 for one that has no running hot water or plumbing? Property expert William Green is staggered.
It's an extraordinary amount of money. If you think that in some parts of the country you could buy a 3, 4, possibly even a 5-bedroom family house for the price of what, I mean, essentially, when it's stripped down, is a wooden shack.
But the company that sold the hut described it as plush and, measuring 18 foot by 10 feet, spacious. A clue to the record price may lie in the stormy financial markets. As one London analyst said today, the rich just don't know where to put their money anymore. They might as well put it in a beach hut. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Okay, the other big story that everybody seems to be talking about still this morning is the Microsoft Surface. Jeremy, what is the big deal with this thing?
Well, it looks kind of like an iPad, but of course it's Microsoft, so it runs Windows, and it has a little keyboard the cover of it turns into a keyboard.
Fancy.
So it solves that problem, I guess, that the iPad has. It was unveiled yesterday at what was a very Apple-esque event from Microsoft. For more on this, let's bring in John Moe, host of Marketplace Tech Report. He's with us now. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, first, let's start with the significance of this tablet for Microsoft. How badly does the company need this to succeed?
Really, 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 really badly. It's Microsoft has been trying to get into the mobile space, where if you ask anybody, the future of computing, the future of devices is the mobile space. It's tablets, it's phones. And Microsoft, which used to be the king of personal computing, is watching Apple gobble up more and more market share in that space. They feel like they're probably getting lapped. The Windows smartphone is launched, but it hasn't exactly taken off. So I think they said, look, we need to get this out the door. And you can see in the urgency that they launched this without a lot of details. We don't know everything about the screen resolution, the memory, the power. We have no idea about the price, and we don't even know the launch date.
Does Microsoft have to be careful about this? Are they going to anger the companies that have traditionally made the hardware that uses Windows software like Lenovo or Acer?
Probably, yeah. And I think they decided that that was worth it. That was the lesser of two evils. It was either wait and build a consensus or make a bold move on their own. I mean, and a bold move into hardware, which has paid off for them with the Xbox, but hasn't paid off on, say, the Zune. So it's a high-risk maneuver, but they felt it was warranted.
Now, John, I mentioned that it was sort of an Apple-esque unveiling of this thing. Is the Surface supposed to be like an iPad or something different?
Well, it has this built-in keyboard. It has a cover that is sort of like the cover on the iPad right now, actually, is sort of magnetic cover. The difference is that it has this keyboard on it. It also has some USB ports so you can plug more things into it. It's got a kickstand built into the back. It's got complexity where the iPad has simplicity. And I think that's the ultimate separation of the propositions that the two different companies are making.
John Moe, host of Marketplace Tech Report, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeremy, I don't know if you remember, about 5 years ago, there was another Microsoft product called the Surface. Did you
really?
Notice that at the time?
No,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
And it could not be more different. It was a table, a giant table, like that you would set at a bar, and you'd set your drinks on it, and little like images would emanate out from the drinks, and you would, you know, this was right about the time when the world was switching to portable tablets, and oddly enough, you could never really buy a Microsoft Surface table. Somebody made an amazing parody of the Microsoft Surface at the time.
Now consider this. Instead of using one of today's more popular compact devices to get directions to where you're going, why not use a device the size of a small car to do the same job.
Well, my big question, Jeff, about the new Surface for Microsoft is whether it means that the keyboard may be with us for a little bit longer. I wonder, you know, I thought maybe the keyboard was starting to go away with the switch toward tablet computers with no keyboards, but maybe we'll be doing QWERTY for a little while longer.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/the Big Book.
Google is out with its latest transparency report, which tells people what governments have asked the search giant to remove content. This year, the worst offender was India.
Here to talk with us about it is Rebecca Rosen of The Atlantic, who's been following the story. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So India asked for the most content to be removed. Is that the worst government, can we say, for internet freedom then?
I don't think you could say that India is the worst government for internet freedom. I mean, you certainly see a really high rate of requests coming from India, which is definitely a problem. And you see a really low rate of compliance from Google's part for those requests. I think the figure is 29%. So that means that in Google's judgment, a lot of those requests were either overly broad or overreaching in some way. But user data requests is only a small tool that governments use to tamp down on free flow of information online. And I think there are much worse offenders, particularly China, stands out when you're looking at the global picture for internet freedom.
And so why isn't China at the top of the list?
China actually had, I think, zero requests, because they control the flow of information with other means, and they're not just looking for pieces of information to come out of Google, but they actually limit access to many Google products.
How does the U.S. stack up?
Well, you know, it is hard to compare across countries, but we did see a big increase in the number of content removal requests from the American government since the last reporting period, which was the first half of 2011.
And finally, Google's been doing this for a couple of years, putting out this report. Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that the censorship situation is getting more free, or are there more takedown requests?
It's really hard to know just from the data we have here if things are getting worse or better, partly because just the nature of the request. Like if you see more requests from a certain country, there may have been a specific incident that provoked that trend. I mean, Google says that the thing that they have observed is that for every report, there have been instances of governments requesting the removal of political speech. And Google calls that trend alarming, and I think everyone would agree that that's alarming. It's also not particularly surprising at this point, unfortunately. But I think the other thing that we're seeing with each iteration is that the report has gotten a lot better. So you can't necessarily compare report to report, but you do see a more full picture emerging from inside the company. In particular, and this is one thing we haven't touched on yet, they just last month released a whole new section of the report that goes into pretty great detail about the requests they get from private companies to take down information or websites that link to copyrighted information. And that's a whole other big piece of how information flows online and the efforts to stop that.
Rebecca Rosen of The Atlantic, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I just want to say, if people haven't had a chance to poke through this yet, there is a lot of really juicy examples in there. And you can't say scientifically, you know, why countries on the whole are complaining about whatnot. But like my favorite was from Canada. Canada doesn't have a lot of complaints. But get this, their passport office wanted Google to take down a YouTube video of somebody going to the bathroom on their Canadian passport and then flushing it down the toilet. Apparently, it went down the toilet, according to that account. So what do you think Google says to that request, Jeremy?
Well, I guess whatever they said to it, the news of it obviously got out. So they let that cat out of the bag.
A little embarrassing. But, you know, you got to hand it to Google. Like a lot of these, they stuck to their guns. They say, we're not taking that video down. Tough luck for you, Canada. So let's switch gears here. You remember J.R. Ewing and Dallas?
Sure.
Of course they do. They're remaking Dallas on TNT, right? Is it right now? Well, one real-life family, the Kerrs, are a little like the Ewings of Oklahoma City. Today in a New York courtroom, the company Kerr McGee is being sued for $25 billion. And here's the issue, environmental pollution. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here is Scott Tong.
Kerr-McGee's founder, Robert Kerr, started a company that in its heyday sold everything from oil and gas to uranium and chemicals. He later became governor, senator, philanthropist. His great-nephew is Aubrey McClendon, the controversial founder of Chesapeake Energy and the part owner of the NBA's Oklahoma City Thunder. At issue in court is Kerr-McGee's old railroad tie sites. They took wood planks and soaked them in a chemical sludge called creosote.
I have stage 4 metastatic renal cell carcinoma.
Janet Russo grew up next to a chemical site in Pennsylvania. Middle-aged women like her hardly ever get this cancer.
It's basically, they said, environmentally caused. I'm convinced it's because of the creosote, only because I can't think of anything else that it would be.
Russo and 8,000 others are suing Kerr-McGee. But a few years back, it spun off a new firm responsible for pollution payouts. It went bankrupt. Intentional fraud? That's the question. Jay Westbrook teaches law at the University of Texas.
The classic instance would be the guy who's being sued by everybody for one thing or another and gives all of his assets to his mother and then says, okay, creditors, I've got nothing left. What do you want to do about that?
Kerr-McGee denies wrongdoing. It's now part of another oil giant, Anadarko. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
By the way, Scott snuck into that old railroad tie chemical site in Pennsylvania, and you can check that out on marketplace.org.
In Rio de Janeiro tomorrow, the United Nations is holding a big conference on sustainable development. It's called Rio Plus 20 because it's been 20 years since a similar summit in Rio that led to the Kyoto Protocol climate agreement. Ivo de Boer spent years as a top UN official on climate change, but at this year's conference, he's going to be representing the accounting firm KPMG, where he works as an advisor on climate change. Mr. de Boer joins us now. Good morning.
Morning.
Well, if you look at the list of people who are not going to this summit, it's some pretty big names. President Obama looks like he's not going. David Cameron, the UK prime minister, the leader of Germany, Angela Merkel. What's going on here?
Difficult times. I think that many political leaders are preoccupied at this moment with the economic and financial crisis that we're seeing. Then in many of the countries that you mentioned, including the United States, this is an election year, which is keeping politicians at home. Plus, I think, thirdly, that many people want to get a clear understanding of what exactly this conference is going to be focusing on.
Well, don't you think, though, that the politicians are simply reflecting the fact that this is not among their constituents' top concerns, that climate change is not number one on most voters' minds?
I think it's correct to say that climate change and other sustainability issues are probably not at the front of the mind of many voters. But at the same time, I do think that politicians have the responsibility to think ahead. And my feeling is that on energy prices, energy security, material scarcity, water scarcity, food scarcity, population growth, we're either at a series of tipping points or perhaps even past them.
Why did you get into the private sector to work on this issue?
Because I believe that the private sector, at the end of the day, holds many of the solutions that we need in order to really come to grips with some of these global megaforces.
Why is that?
Because the private sector is driving our economy. I don't think that you would want to change the direction of economic growth against the will of employment, against the will of the private sector, against the will of what makes economic sense. And for all of those reasons, this really needs to be a partnership between the public and the private sector.
As you travel around the world, what's the best country when it comes to dealing with climate change? Who's doing a really good job at this?
I'm probably going to mention a country that will surprise you. I think in terms of understanding that we fundamentally need to change the direction of economic growth, China, for me, is way out in front. China is the world number one investor now in wind energy, in solar energy, in battery technology. It has massive plans to create sustainable cities, to focus much more strongly on recycling. And I think that that is because that country recognizes that their model of economic growth basically cannot take them forward.
Ivo de Boer is Special Global Advisor for Climate Change and Sustainability at the accounting firm KPMG. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
FedEx reports earnings today. Analysts are predicting higher profits, 5% or more over a year ago. As the world's biggest cargo airline company, FedEx is usually a pretty good gauge of how the broader economy is doing. But right now, FedEx's growth may be more a reflection of changing buying habits by consumers. Chris Christopher is a senior economist with IHS Global Insight.
FedEx is more related to e-commerce retail sales, which is outperforming the overall economy. So FedEx's performance might be a little stronger than the economic numbers are sort of telling us.
And rival UPS saw its profits rise 10% in the most recent quarter.
Well, Jeff, most of airline flying these days involves things you don't want to think about even. Baggage fees, tiny seats, and microwave chicken if you even get any food at all. But that doesn't mean we can't dream. A new survey by a company called Skyscanner asked people what they want from airline travel. Free use of iPads was on the list. Massage chairs, that would be nice. 8% wanted anti-kick seats installed.
What is that? Do we know what an anti-kick seat is?
Maybe it's got like titanium behind you so that the person can't kick you or you wouldn't feel it.
A little hammer comes out and wraps children on the knee if they...
Well, no, they've got a plan for that too. 18% of the respondents to this survey said there should be a soundproof section of the plane for kids.
Oh, they're dreaming. You know what I'd like? I would like puppies on board. You know, like at a, you know, you go to a nursing home or something, they could bring out dogs and cats for you to pet. I think that'd be great to have.
I don't know about
just
that.
Just to relieve the tension for everybody.
Maybe.
Have you seen the preview for the new Hobbit movie yet that's coming out?
No.
Well, I caught a preview for it the other night, and it looked okay, actually a little bit dull, but I'm sure it's going to be great. Fans are totally jacked that this is coming out. Apparently, theater owners are not. Now, Peter Jackson, who is the director of the three Lord of the Rings movies, he did this one too, and its sequel, Hobbit Part 2, whatever it is. But he shot the movie at twice the sort of standard frame rate in the industry. This is like state of the art. And for theaters to show The Hobbit in all of its intended glory, they have to invest in a bunch of expensive projection equipment.
Hmm.
They're not real happy about that. But here's where it gets worse. A few folks who've seen big parts of the movie say it actually, at this new frame rate, it looks too real. It basically looks like actors in their costumes standing on movie sets.
Wow.
So some kind of unfortunate early reviews of the Hobbit movie. One guy was
writing.
I don't
know if that's unfortunate. That sounds pretty cool if it actually looks too real.
It's really behind the scenes.
Yeah,
you're in the movie, but maybe a little bit too much. One guy described it as a high-def version of the 1970s I, Claudius, which we haven't seen. It is kind of kind of rough. He also called it a soap opera look like you get from a badly calibrated TV at Best Buy.
Wow.
A little too close for
that's
comfort.
Rough.
People want their movies to be a little more distant, a little fuzzy, I guess. Anyway, in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.